it's time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday, the 6th of September 2014. Island Life is Waiheke Radio's weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday from 10 till 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oneroa. I'm Chris Walker, and on Saturday the 6th of September, I spoke to Waiheke Island Returning Officer for the General Election, Dee Ostring, about early voting places. I spoke with Kim Whittaker and Janice McArdle from the Waiheke Theatre Company, and I was joined by Greg Treadwell, a senior lecturer in journalism at AUT University. And in 2 weeks' time, 2 weeks today, the general election 2014, we will find out who will be our government for the next 3 years. However, you don't have to wait until Saturday the 20th of September to cast your vote, and I've got the returning officer for Waiheke Island, Dee Ostring, on the phone. How are you, Dee? Hello, Dee, you there? Oh, there we go. Dee. Hello, Dee, how are you?
Morena, Chris. I'm well, thank you.
Excellent. So I was just saying, Dee, that the... I hadn't clicked you through onto my line, so you couldn't hear me.
Oh, okay.
But just saying that, you know, with the election in 2 weeks' time, 20th of September,
Yep. Of
course, but people don't have to wait, do they, to cast a vote?
Absolutely not. There's always been special or advanced voting available, and they're actually encouraging whoever wants to vote, whoever knows who they're going to vote for and wants to go ahead and place their vote, if it's even the slightest bit inconvenient to do it on election day, do it in advance. So they've got these advanced voting facilities all over the place. There's only one on Waiheke, and it's in our new lovely library building. And we're back in the... When you enter, just go straight to the back, and we're in the right corner there in what they call the quiet room.
And is that operating the same hours as the library day?
No, it's not. What we have is we're operating Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. until 4 p.m. We've got a late night on Thursday. We're open till 8, and the library is actually staying open an extra 2 hours to allow us to stay open till 8 o'clock. And then on Saturday, next Saturday, we'll be there from 11 a.m. until 2 p.m. So it's restricted hours. It's 6 hours a day except for Thursday and 3 hours on the Friday.
Okay.
On the Saturday.
So it does give people plenty of opportunity, doesn't it, in the lead up. So people, you know, if they've got sports on Saturday the 20th or something like that, they can make sure they can get in and cast their vote.
Absolutely. Or if they just want a little more time, if they're a special votes take time, and on election day it does get a bit crowded sometimes and you might have to wait a while. Hopefully you won't have to wait quite as long for us. We have a few people there. There's not a lot of us at first, but we'll be gearing up and bringing more people in for the last couple of days. Please do be patient with us. This will be the first time for a lot of people issuing the votes, and we do have a very strict process to go through to make sure that your vote actually is valid and will count. So people need to be a little bit patient with us, but they're welcome to come on in and place their advance votes anytime with us.
Now, in recent elections, Dee, people have been sent out a voting card to their address.
That's correct.
Yeah. Have those gone out yet?
Not yet. They won't be coming out until next week. So from next week, if you've got that card with you, do bring it in. It makes everything a lot faster. But if you don't have your card, just come in and give us your name if you're on the local rolls that we have there. So that'll be the Auckland Central roll or the Hauraki Waikato roll. And if you're not on one of those two rolls, you just give us your address where you registered, and we need to just look it up and verify that, yes, we know what electorate that is, and then we'll give you your papers and everything. So, yep. But election is an amazing thing because it's the one thing in New Zealand where absolutely everyone counts equally. It doesn't matter what age, gender, education level, IQ, religion, sexual orientation, nothing of that matters except that you are a New Zealand resident or a citizen, and that you've lived here, are registered here. And even if you're not registered, you can register up through midnight on the 19th. So as long as you're 18, by midnight on the 19th, you'll be able to register online, or we've got a form that you can fill in and come in and cast your vote.
So for people who are an electorate, there really is no difference between casting an early vote and doing it on Saturday the 20th, is there?
Correct, absolutely. Well, for nobody, there's no difference. It's all handled just exactly the same. So if you're a special vote, it's the same process whether you're doing it beforehand or whether you're doing it on the day. If you can't get out to a voting place, if it's difficult for you to get out at all, you can get what's called a takeaway vote. You can send someone in to us with just write a little note saying, please, will you allow this person to get papers for me? Give us name, address, etc., and we'll issue what's called a takeaway vote. The person that's been authorized takes that back to you. You cast your vote, and then they need to return it to either to the advance vote office or to any voting place on election day, as long as it's in before 7 o'clock when the polls close.
And do you go and visit, say, people who might be immobile and so on? I mean, is that how they do that? Or, say, at the retirement village and so on, is there a special opportunity for those people to cast a vote?
Not on the island. We don't have voting teams going out. In the city, there are voting teams that go out to the jails, hospitals, some of the retirement homes, places like that. But there's no place on the island where people are sequestered like that, and so there's no place on the island that we have a team going out to. If you do have any difficulty getting out, as I said, you can apply for a takeaway vote, or you can ring the electorate office, the headquarters. I can give you a phone number in a moment for that. Or you can just get in touch with us somehow. We can send out a postal ballot as well. As long as we know far enough in advance, we can mail you your ballot and you can get it back into us. So we try to make it easy for everyone to cast their vote. If you have any problems, get in touch with us. The Auckland headquarters number is 520-7521. And there's also the number online for the whole elections process, the national number. There's an 0800 number that is available, and hang on, I'm just not finding it right now. It's online at elections.org.nz is the website, and one thing that I found really intriguing this time is that there's a graph there that shows that they update daily with the advanced vote period.
Yeah, I'm just looking at that graph at the moment, and in the first 2 days of advance voting, significantly higher turnout. I mean, I think probably there has been more focus on advance voting this election. There are a number of organisations not connected with the Electoral Commission who are promoting that, things like the Get Out and Vote campaign and Rock and Roll, who are promoting early voting. And it seems to be having a significant impact, with already something like, it looks like around, 14,500 early votes cast compared to 5,802 2011.
Yeah, more than twice as much. They were expecting it to be a bit higher. It was higher in 11 than it was in 08, and they were expecting it to be higher, but I don't think they were expecting it to be this much higher. So if this carries on, they're going to be very pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
There's also an 0800 number, 0800-367656. So you can ring either of those numbers and let them know that you've got what issue you've got, and we'll make sure it gets taken care of, because we want to be sure that everyone can cast a vote.
And so just run us through the hours that the polling booth is open at the library again, Dee.
Okay, so Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. until 4 p.m. Thursday we have a late night, so we're open on Thursday night until 8 p.m. And on Saturday from 11 a.m. till 2 p.m.
Okay, and that's next Saturday, not today.
Correct, next Saturday. So we start on Monday here.
Okay. Great.
Yep. And up through the Friday before Election Day, through the Friday the 19th.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for joining us, Dee.
And, you're very welcome.
Yeah. And, we encourage everyone to get along and cast their vote. Thanks very much.
Yes, please do.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
That was Dee Ostring, the returning officer for Waiheke Island.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
I've been joined now by two people from the Waiheke Theatre Company, Janice McCardle and Kim Whittaker, who are both here with us this morning. Good morning to you both.
Morning.
Morning.
And they're here to talk to us about an upcoming production. It's been a busy year, really, for the Waiheke Theatre Company, isn't it? You seem to be in here every couple of weeks promoting a new performance or production of some sort or another.
Yeah, I think the aim was to have four productions in the year, one every quarter. This one seems to have come quite quickly on the heels of Ladies for Hire. I think it was just by quirk of the diary for the theatre when there were spaces available.
And so this production is two plays, is that right?
And Yeah, it's two one-act plays, subtitles obviously called Lovers, and subtitled Winners and Losers. And the first act, Winners, features two absolutely gorgeous young people from Waiheke High School.
That's Jacob Legg and Stella Andrews. Who, in fact, one of the nice things about it is that the high school has arranged that they can actually use the production for credits for their NCAE, which I think is a wonderful thing and something we hope will continue in other areas with the theatre as well, to get those links with the high school and what's going on here at Artworks and in the theatre in general.
And the young lovers, Stella and Joe, their characters, are an absolute contrast to the older middle-aged lovers, played by Kim and myself, in the second act, which is Losers. And it's a very typical Irish play in that it said that with many of the Irish playwrights, they suck you in with the humour and then they kind of give you that kind of wham to the belly, and this one's no different. It's a beautifully written play. The playwright is Brian Friel, one of the more prolific Irish playwrights. It's set in 1967 in a little place called Ballymore in Ireland, so all of the cast have had to work on their Irish accents, which has been an interesting challenge.
How's that going? Are you able to maintain it through the whole production, or does it tail off towards the end?
Oh, no, it's absolutely perfect, Chris, I can tell you. We never lose it at all, not till the very end.
And we're also very good at swearing in the Irish as well.
And quite often when things go wrong during the production, we stay in the Irish to talk about it and curse about it.
We do very good cursing.
So that must have been for your high school, players in the first of the two plays. That would be something new, I presume, working an accent through a whole play.
Yeah, I think so. Although interestingly, one of them, Jacob Legg, is originally, I think, from Massachusetts. And what's quite interesting is that American accent actually converts a little bit or more easily, I think, into an Irish accent. So I think he's in some ways found that easier, whereas for Stella Andrews, I think that probably has been quite a challenge, but she's doing it very well, and they come over very, very nicely as a couple.
Now, you were saying, Janice, that there's a lot of humour in here, and I suppose when you look at it on paper, you know, the story of a young couple, very young couple with an impending baby and kind of looking ahead to a life ahead that maybe not what they'd hoped for, and then the other a married couple looking back and going, you know, where have we been? It doesn't come across as a bundle of laughs when you look at it in that way.
But that's why the writing in this play is so beautiful, and it's a real challenge for the actors too, to sort of play it in a very nuanced way. So we're not actually playing it for the laughs. It's that way that the Irish write. It's almost a self-deprecating humour. It also gives some insights into love and the disappointments of love, but done in that way where we all go, you just get that moment and you go, ooh, yes, I've been there, or I've seen that. And we kind of laugh a little bit at ourselves as human beings in the play. But there are some lovely, lovely lines. And if we, you know, if the audience just sits there and listens, they'll get hit in the belly by some of it.
And I'm imagining that these are both fairly minimal in terms of kind of staging and production and, you know, pyrotechnics and all of that.
Yeah, it's been quite an interesting one, because the two plays, one takes place on the top of a hill, and the other one takes place inside or around a small Irish cottage, which including quite a lot of it in the bedroom. So it's actually, for the set and so on, it's quite a challenge, but I think it's worked quite well.
But it must put a lot more pressure on, you know, because you've got the focus very much on two people throughout.
Yes, it's an interesting the way that he's written it, because in the first one, there are actually four people in it. There are the two actors, and then there are two commentators who speak directly to the audience and help to tell the story. In the second one, it's similar in the way in which what's called the fourth wall is broken, and Andy actually speaks directly to the audience and tells the story of Hannah and his relationship in a direct narration to the audience, and then they go back into actually carrying out and performing some of the scenarios from that from both of the stories. So it's quite a unique way of doing it, and very interesting, I think, both for the performers and for the audience.
Were the two written to be performed as one piece like this, or is that something you've brought together?
No, they're absolutely written by Brian Friel as two sides to the one coin, and there are some very similar themes in it. But just going back to your question about the set, one of the most challenging parts is that played by Eileen Evans, Mammy Wilson, and she has to play her entire scene sitting up in bed, and she's this absolutely manipulative, cloying mother-in-law. And so her challenge is to deliver all of that while sitting in her bed with a bright pink bow on her head, trying to look sickly sweet, but very, very powerful character.
And this, tell us about the run of Lovers.
Opens on Thursday, Thursday 11th, 7:30. Then we, on the following two nights, 12th and the 13th, that's the Friday and the Saturday. And then there's a matinee on the 14th at 2 o'clock. Then the following week, 18th, 19th and 20th, that's the Thursday, Friday and Saturday nights.
Yeah,
at 7:30.
And are you drawing good houses, Ladies for Hire? Got good numbers coming through?
The second week they had very good houses. There were sellouts for all of the second week. At the first week, as often happens with these productions, you know, word has to get around, and then they usually pick up when they see what high quality the shows are.
Brilliant. And so this is the third of four, is that right?
Yes, there's another one that they're planning, and well, it's on the cards, is going to be The Vicar of Dibley, which is going to be performed in December, I think, is
right.
The plan at the moment.
Mm. Excellent. Okay, well, thanks very much for joining us, Janice and Kim. And we look forward to Lovers, Winners, Losers, which is starting, as Kim said, on Thursday at 7:30 p.m. So not long. A few more rehearsals before then.
Time to panic.
Absolutely. We're bricking it, as they say. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much for joining us this morning. That's Kim Whittaker and Janice McArdle from the Waiheke Theatre Company.
You're listening to Island Life, Waiheke people, events and issues, brought to you by Island, art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac, Ocean View Road, Onirua.
This is Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, and I suppose looking at the wider world from a Waiheke perspective. And here to do that with us this morning is a senior lecturer in journalism at AUT University and an island resident, Greg Tribwell. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning, Chris.
So obviously we've just kind of been canvassing with the opinionated islanders, the election and dirty politics being such a central part of this, and getting into the whole area of journalism and reporting and coverage. But following on from the opinionated islanders, I thought we might talk to someone who knows what they're talking about.
That's nice of you. I think they're great, the opinionated islanders. It's always good, actually, for people to push the boundaries of opinion. And I guess that's what we should talk about today.
Well, I'm interested in this because I think, you know, if we look at reporting, you know, whether it's to do with politics or anything else, there's a spectrum and a continuum from, you know, from fact through analysis to opinion. And all are valid and all have their place. But I suppose what we're starting to see, perhaps in the media, both in, you know, in the what's referred to as the blogosphere, and in now, you know, mainstream media, which, you know, 10 years ago no one was talking about that. It was just the media. But
yeah.
But that spectrum perhaps is becoming a bit blurred, isn't it?
I think it's extremely blurred. I think that. There's a relatively strong understanding in the public of the media's role, but less of an understanding of the genre divisions, if you like, within the media. So I worry that people don't clearly enough understand the difference between so-called fact and opinion. And of course, with the development of media theorists over the last 20 odd years, probably the best known as Noam Chomsky, he's probably not as popular these days as he was when he first hit the world with the idea of manufacturing consent, which is his idea that the mainstream media does, among a lot of good stuff, its very inherent nature is to actually reinforce the status quo and not really challenge it. So there's a kind of myth that it challenges it. We've got these ideas this much more broadly in society now. There's a much more critical look at the media in some ways, in that way, the role of the media in a society. But how much is the understanding is there of the divisions within the mainstream media? And you're right, the term the mainstream media has developed, MSM is what the insiders call it now. The mainstream media is divided into fact, opinion, comment, and other things. And of course, people who take a Chomsky-type point of view say it isn't fact, it's just political reinforcement. But if you accept that within mainstream society there's a need for a mainstream media, then it is fact. Reportage is built on facts, and we tell our journalism students that a news story is nothing but a series of facts that build an argument. So it's certainly the reporter's opinion that this is a news story, that this contains news values, that it's newsworthy, that it's important for the public to know about it. People's opinions come into the creation of a story quite a lot, but nevertheless a news story is different from an opinion piece, a comment piece, a column, or even a feature. So even within news reporting, the distinction between news stories and feature stories is important, because feature stories have an opening for more opinion from the reporter. But a news story is just a series of facts. A feature has a bit more opinion, and then at the other end, as you quite rightly call it, a continuum, at the other end of the continuum is pure opinion. And that's where the blogs live. Are they part of journalism? You know, we've got to have to say some are and some aren't. I know that Whale Oil is a blog. Cameron Slater won a Canon Media Award. I personally think that's extremely disappointing and problematic for the notion of mainstream media. But is his work journalism? I'm going to say absolutely not. So we need to understand that even within the world of comment, there is journalistic comment and then there is political comment. And they're two quite different things.
So I suppose we see, for a lot of people, the source of their news might be something like ZB News Talk. You know, and, I mean, look at the name of it. You know, the name of the station is ZB News Talk. And you've got, sure, you've got news bulletins in that format, but you've also got people who I would venture have moved beyond analysis of the news stories into opinion. You know, people like some of the people on there, like, Layton Smith and so on. And they're very much giving a personal opinion, but it's sitting in that news context. It becomes quite confusing, doesn't it? And where does the responsibility lie for someone who is a presenter in that situation, who purports to be presenting the news?
That's a very good question, Chris. The radio hosts, perhaps like yourself, have a role within the dissemination of information. Is Layton Smith a news maker? I mean, a news presenter? No. Is Mike Hosking? That's a more difficult one, because he purports to be.
Well, but recently when there was the criticism of him hosting the leaders' debate, because he has expressed, you know, very openly opinions around politics and who he favours, that he said in response to that, he said, well, I'm not a journalist, I'm a broadcaster.
Yeah, and I think he's right. I think he's right. He's not a journalist. But I also think that his role across the different media confuses things. So at News Talk ZB, he has one role. On 7 Sharp, he has another. And I think that we have become confused about what his role is. Yeah, he's not a journalist. I knew he wasn't a journalist the moment I heard that he was driving a Maserati. And that's not just about the pay of a journalist, that's about the role of a journalist. He's become an elitist. He's well known for having attacked a woman who very gently bumped his bumper in Newmarket one day, called her a moron on social media. The journalists just don't hold this position of elitism and... I've known for a long time he's not a journalist, but I'm not sure the public have that clear view of Hosking's role. Then we get him hosting electoral debates, and I understand, I didn't see the minor parties, minor leaders debate, but I understand he did a good job. I've heard some commentary that he did a good job. So I think it's Mike Hosking in particular is the most confused and confusing media personality around. I'd like to see some accountability, some open and transparent stuff from the stations that use him, both in television and radio. Yeah, if you haven't heard Jeremy Wells's takeoff of Mike Hosking, I highly recommend it. Every Friday morning, I believe, he's just quite extraordinary. And it isn't just his ability to mimic Hosking, it's how he outlines in his satire the very problems that Hosking, problematic kind of personality and role that Hosking brings to the media world.
If we look at, say one of the most mainstream of mainstream media, so the New Zealand Herald, where you've got some professional obligation to present facts and balance, and I would imagine that they take the editorial responsibility around that very strongly as well. And if you kind of get back to your point earlier around Noam Chomsky and so on, you know, is it actually possible? And people now, say in the blogosphere, would criticise and say, well, look, it's a charade. It's impossible to actually present that kind of balance and to be completely neutral. You're better off just wearing your colours on your sleeves and saying, this is where I'm coming from.
Yeah, it's a toughie. In New Zealand, we have a long history of news organisations, on the outside at least, not taking a public stance at a party political level or even at a political ideology level. Although we know, of course, anybody who has any kind of political science learning behind them can see where the Herald stands. It's pretty straightforward. Is it better just to be more out and out? That happens in England so much more, of course, particularly with the red tops, with the tabloid newspapers. It's very clear who they support, and they're quite happy even to attack politicians at a very personal level on their front pages without the word comment or opinion anywhere near the story. It happens at a higher tier in the British media as well. We know where the Times sits, we know where the Guardian sits, we know where the Independent sits. New Zealand is in a slightly, in some ways, a more disadvantageous position because we simply don't have the population for a publication like the Herald to risk alienating some of its readership by being openly one way or the other. So the Herald, for all its failings, has an incredibly hard job to do, which is to be all things to everyone. Now, I have less of a problem with their politics than their understanding of their audience. So I think the huge mistake the Herald is making is that it's still writing for the aging white middle class classes of Auckland, simply does not acknowledge that its audience could be a massively colourful and interesting diversity of Auckland communities. And so we've seen over the last 10 or so years, with the Herald failing to serve those communities, they've started their own newspapers. Their newspapers aren't necessarily high quality, they don't have the training, they don't have the understanding of balance, so you get some pretty awful stuff in some of the Chinese language newspapers, some of the Pacifica newspapers of South Auckland, the Indian Weekend or a Newslink, a wonderful publication. So there's a mix of quality. But the Herald, it can't simply come out openly in support of John Key, although we know that it has a centre-right leaning. If it came out and said, vote John Key, it would lose so many readers, it wouldn't be viable as a newspaper. In London, you need a certain number of readers to sustain a newspaper. They can sustain numerous newspapers, irrespective of what leanings they show. So I think that's where the New Zealand media finds itself. It's caught in an unfortunate place. It has leanings, but it's too risky to show them.
Yeah, and it does kind of fudge it, doesn't it? If you look at a feature like, say, the Herald's Porkometer, which is one that particularly gets to me, because the whole positioning of that is that, you know, so yes, they can say, let's look at the facts. We can add up the facts of how much parties have said they'll spend, but placing it within that context of a Porkometer very clearly says, we believe that spending is bad.
Yeah, exactly.
And, which is a political,
which is a position itself.
Position. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely it is.
Yeah.
And I think in many ways, the two issues that we're describing, the behaviour of the mainstream media and not really allowing any serious criticism of the system, quote-unquote, and the other position where it has to take a relatively neutral position within mainstream politics, those two things can blend, and this is where the Porkometer comes in. This is a statement that we should not be challenging, or we should be challenging the spending, but it's not a discussion about that. It starts from a very biased position. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. And and as you say, the alternatives, you know, perhaps in terms of resourcing and coverage are more limited. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about, and I know it's a passion of yours, is this whole information idea of, you know, freedom of information. And we have in New Zealand the Official Information Act, and which is, you know, I mean, I worked in the public service in the 1980s. And when I started, we had to sign numerous forms. And one of the things that we signed at that point was basically something to say that we understood that everything was secret unless we were explicitly told that it wasn't. The Official Information Act, the intent of that, and I'll let you talk more about this because you've done more research on it, but as I understand it, was to turn that on its head and to say everything is open unless there's a good reason why not.
That's really succinctly put, Chris. That's exactly what it was. Prior to 1982, we had a piece of legislation called the Official Secrets Act 1951, which was essentially yet another colonial descendant of British law. So we had the Official Secrets Act, and as you quite rightly say, all information held by the government was deemed to be secret unless state officials were given permission from somebody above them to release it. In practice, of course, we were a much more open society already than that would imply pre 1982. So the Official Information Act came in 1982 for a number of reasons. One was it was simply time. Society already was not behaving as the 1951 Secrets Act would suggest. So people were getting information. We weren't just a completely closed and secret society prior to 1982. But it was time to legislate that for that new openness. The marvelous thing about the New Zealand Official Information Act, I think we were in the first piece of official information legislation actually dates back 200 years to Sweden. They had an anomalous moment in political history when, while the government's attention was elsewhere, a liberal politician managed to squeak through some legislation saying that information held by the government must be made available to the public. Nothing happened in that realm, anything like it, until 1967, when the United States of America passed its piece of freedom of information legislation. Then in the early 1980s, there was a sort of sudden little wave of liberal countries like New Zealand and Australia and Canada, who did it all in 1982, all brought in these amazing pieces of legislation. New Zealand's was celebrated as the most amazing, although initially some academics and politicos in Australia were laughing at us because it was so liberal, they said it would never work. There was no control for the government. The difference, in my view, was that we didn't ask politicians to draft this legislation. We asked the officials who would have to deal with it, with the information, to draft it. And we gave them one basic principle of availability to work with. So what in the New Zealand Official Information Act is underpinned by this principle of availability. The information is deemed available already. That means that you and I and every other New Zealander own the information held by the government. They don't have any right to withhold it except for a very small number of exemptions. And of course, the irony of the dirty politics one is that the information from the SIS that was passed in a very hurried manner to Cameron Slater was, in fact, information that is exempt under the Official Information Act. You ask any journalist, you almost never get any information out of the SIS because it's a security of the nation issue. So the SIS is deemed to be able to keep anything it likes pretty much secret because they're in charge of the security of the nation and they simply can't risk information getting out that might compromise, undermine that security. So we passed this amazing piece of legislation, incredibly liberal, and the most liberal thing about it, and I think I'm right in saying no other country in the world did this. We didn't even restrict the notion of government information, government-held information, to things being written down on paper. So every other piece of legislation in the world says you can have access to government documents. But we didn't use the word documents, we didn't use the word written, we didn't use the word recorded, we simply talked about information. So even if that information is held in the memory banks of our officials, in theory we have access to it. Now I'm not saying that we can put them in a chair and torture them until they tell us what they know, but in theory that information is also available. So people in Australia did kind of laugh and say, this is ridiculous, you'll never make this work. They were incredibly wrong. We had the most revolutionary piece of freedom of information legislation in the world. It worked better than any other. And initially, at least, the government put the resources into the training of state officials in how to handle requests for information. That was initially an extremely healthy time for New Zealand democracy. But if you think of the timing, and this is where some of my research is based. If you think of the timing, in 1982, it was just 2 years before the election that changed everything. So in 1984, when Robert Muldoon was kicked out, and Longy and Roger Douglas and Richard Preble and the Labour Party were swept into power, everything changed economically in New Zealand. And is there an argument about whether we could ever return to those days? I don't know. That's not the moment. This isn't the moment for discussing that. But what I do know about what happened in New Zealand society was the concept of privatisation became fundamental to the way we run the country. And it's a dualistic model, if you like. Both the state and private enterprise are responsible for providing services to the public. Increasingly more and more over the years, both under Labour and National, and I'm sure whatever government's in next won't be doing anything very different, public money is spent providing services to the public, but services provided by the private sector. So we're talking about the sale of state assets. We're talking about charter schools. The one I have in terms of freedom of information, I have a very big problem with charter schools. Another one is that I have a very big problem with is private prisons. Because although we've only got one in New Zealand, you can be fairly sure that that's the opening of the gate. We pay as taxpayers and New Zealand citizens a lot of money to these companies to provide private prisons, but we can't see how they spend it. We're not allowed to have access to information about private prisons. We can't even see the contract that says to what care our prisoners must be kept, what level of care, and we can't see what they spend our money on. So it's been a massive move since 1982. Is the Official Information Act still adequate is the sort of at the heart of my research, and I'm not at the end of that research. I can't answer that now, but I can tell you what I suspect, and that it absolutely isn't adequate anymore.
So we've got the question of, I suppose, the coverage, you know.
That's what we were talking about.
But I mean, no, the coverage of the Act. You know, so as you say, we've got more and more services that are now contracted to private provision, and so there's restrictions there. So that's, I suppose, something that needs to be looked at about whether we expand that. And then we've got the actual practice of the Act in the areas where it still does apply. And I mean, you've practiced as a journalist for many years, and yep. So you know, official information requests are just kind of stock and trade.
Should be,
and yep. You know, for a journalist. And then we've seen in the last month, I suppose, an exposure of manipulation around that.
Yep.
Has it always been?
I would call it serial abuse.
Yeah, has it always been like that?
No. I, this is what I started off saying. Sorry, I got sidetracked. It hasn't always been like that. In 1982, you can ask investigative journalists, including Nicky Hager, and I've spoken several times to him on this very issue, but many other journalists as well were extremely thrilled with our freedom of information regime, as it's known, in the early 80s. But in came the Labour Party, and actually, I know that she had a lot of fans who believe she was an incredible left-wing leader, but Helen Clark was the one, her government was the one under which it all started to go wrong. Suddenly, officials began to withhold information. There are certain things while I talk about the principle of availability, of course, it has to work. So you can't just say, give me all the information you have on pasture in New Zealand. That's just too big. So you are restricted in ways to, when you're asking for information, to what they call due particularity. But so there are some things that if you get wrong, they can come back to you and say, look, that's not, we can't do that. That's not with due particularity. Or there are some exemptions around free and frank advice to ministers. So ministers, you can't ask for what the officials are advising the ministers until the ministers made up their mind, because it on an issue, because that can subvert everything if that stuff gets out. The principle behind that is that ministers of the Crown should be able to have free and frank and private conversations with their advisers without that becoming public. And some people don't like that idea at all. Personally, I don't have a strong opinion on that one, but what I do know is that over the 90s under Helen Clark's government, these grey areas began to be manipulated by the officials in favour of the government, in favour of privacy. So if you didn't, you have 20 working days as a state official to release information to a requester. If there's a good reason for a delay, you can apply to be granted more time to provide that information. Under Labour in the 90s, every request seemed to be delayed, or there seemed to be a free and frank exemption applied to it. And so from a very open society, we quite quickly began to move into this grey area where, while the Act was still great in principle, the practice of it, as you put it, started to get muddied and mucky and difficult for journalists. And I have to point out here that journalists, in terms of freedom of information regimes, are no different to anybody else. So citizens of any shape, form or colour can apply for information. They have no fewer rights than journalists. Journalists have no extra rights than anybody else, but they tend to be the ones using the Information Act so much more. So there's the second narrative, the first narrative being of the heroic nature of our freedom of information regime since 1982. In the 90s, a second narrative started to appear. And for me, the last month has absolutely crystallized the truth of that second narrative, that despite the efficacy of the Act in theory and in principle, the practice has become distorted, abused, and downright corrupt. Compared to countries well known for corruption, but we're not well known for corruption. People think we're the least corrupt nation in the world. So when we have serial abuse of our official information legislation by the ministers of the Crown, including the Minister of Justice, and the irony in that should never be underestimated, the Minister of Justice has turned out to have been somebody with absolutely no respect for justice. And that's just not okay. And I think I heard the Opinionated Islanders use that same kind of approach. It's simply not acceptable in this democracy, or indeed in any, for the freedom of information regime to be abused in favour of the incumbent government. Mm-hmm. And of course, what we know happened was, if you're a journalist, as I said earlier, if you ask for information from the SIS, you can expect to be turned down, unless apparently you're Cameron Slater.
And this is fascinating stuff, and unfortunately we do need to wrap it up, and I'm hoping that you can come back in the future, Greg, because...
Be very pleased.
Yeah, I think I'd like to get into the whole kind of thing of sources, you know, and sources for journalists and kind of protection of sources and so on, but we haven't got time to do that now, yeah. But I would like to do that in the future. Greg Tribble, Senior Lecturer in Journalism at AUT University, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Greg, for having me.
You've been listening to the Interviews from Island Life, a weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua.